Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
You maniac! You maniac! You blew it up! You blew it up! Damn you! Damn you! Damn you!
Very pretty game night, taking your very pretty game, taking your call, and say this is a silly answer about exciting topics, silly about exciting topics, exploring topics, exploring topics, and teaching their coming directly, and teaching their parents. Call
your manager! You blew it up! Damn you! Damn you all!
Tonight, Barry, Chris, and Jamie are taking your calls as they dish the dirt on this year's Cannes Film Festival, spilling the beans about exciting topics to guests for future shows, exploring their top 10 lists of upcoming directors, and choosing their flicks of the week with special guest critic Jeremy. The number to call is 718-508-9477. Once again, that's 718-508-9477. Movie Geeks, the world rejoice. This is your moment. Here are your hosts, Jerry, Chris, and Jamie.
Okay, welcome to another edition of Movie Geeks United. I'm Jerry, here with my co-hosts, Jamie and Chris.
Hey, guys.
What's up, everybody? We're happy to be here.
Likewise, sorry about that technical difficulties in the beginning.
No, that was, Charlton Heston saying that over himself. It sounded like the demon in The Exorcist when it talks backwards, you know?
Okay.
So how's everybody doing tonight?
Doing pretty good. We're doing pretty good.
Feeling pretty good. I got my coffee. I got my cigar. And I'm ready to talk about movies, about Cannes Film Festival, and everything else.
Okay, great. All right, we want to first give out our phone number if you want to give us a call at 718-508-9477. We would really love to hear from you. If you're too shy, you can email us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. And we have a website at MySpace, myspace.com/moviegeeksunited. And I guess what we want to start out the show with is the big news about the Cannes Film Festival, which the three of us have been following for the last couple of days. And you guys have any thoughts on anything you've heard so far?
It's an exciting lineup of films. And I tell you, the thing that's making headlines right now primarily is the Michael Moore film, isn't it? The Sicko.
Yeah, Sicko is definitely making the rounds. It got a standing ovation. 2,000 people gave it a standing ovation at the premiere.
Yeah.
Fox News, of all places, said it was brilliant and uplifting. Now, isn't that strange?
That is very strange. That's like an episode of The Twilight Zone. It's like, where's this coming from? Is this reality or what? Fox News, of all places.
I know. I couldn't believe it when I was reading the review and I was reading it to you last night. I mean, this is Fox News. Roger Friedman, of all people, saying this stuff.
Well, I just read something on Entertainment Weekly, their website as well, and they did a quasi-review of it, and they basically said much of the same thing. It shows that a depth of maturity as a filmmaker, that Michael Moore is just letting the topic speak for itself, but there are still places in the film where he kind of showboats because that's his style. But by and large, it's a great leap for Michael Moore as a filmmaker, they say. And it really shines a well-deserved light on this subject that's so, you know, serious and pressing for Americans.
No, now, it really is. Chris, any
lesson after Fahrenheit 9-1-1, you know, he got so much flack for being so one-sided with it, so hopefully he's not going to be making movies that are that, one-sided in the future.
Yeah, but he kind of defended himself. I noticed in the press conference last night, yesterday I was reading about it, and he said, you know, because a lot of people are giving him, why are you praising everyone else's healthcare system, and, you know, they're not all, you know, he said, like a Canadian journalist said, you know, ours isn't perfect, and the Europeans said ours isn't that great either.
Yeah.
So he's still, like, up to his old tricks, I notice.
Yeah, and he defends Fahrenheit 9-1-1, too, vehemently defends everything. I guess he offered $10,000 for anyone that could find a fact in the movie that's, you know, not actually truth. And so far he says he hasn't had to pay any money. So he defends the movie every bit of it.
That's just because he refuses to admit when something he says isn't based on absolute truth.
Yeah, he is like that.
He will say if someone counters an argument with him and says, but what about this? What about that? He'll say, yeah, but you know you can't ignore this part of it. You know he'll kind of give half measures, kind of admit fault, just kind of halfway. But
yeah.
That's how he is. But, you know, Sicko is the talk of Cannes Film Festival so far this year, and it'll be interesting to see how that relates to box office receipts come the end of June when they release it.
I don't know. That kind of movie, you know, that's not it's a hot topic right now, but it's not hot in the way that, you know, it doesn't grab you the way that the title Fahrenheit 9-1-1 does, you know, and the movie came out on the heels of the disaster. That's, you know, people wanted to see that. It was a big deal. This, I don't know. I don't know if a lot of people are going to want to go to the movie to see a documentary about healthcare.
They might, but I mean, it's the title alone. I mean, Sicko. They might not get the. While we know what it is, you know, a lot of people might think, "Oh my God, it's like about a serial killer or something."
Right. It sounds like
They will see it when they see the poster for the film, because I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's him. It's Michael Moore sitting in a doctor's office waiting room, and on both sides of him are skeletons. And it says below, and it says, a new comedy from Michael Moore. It doesn't even promote it as a documentary. It promotes it as a comedy.
Hey, well, good
well,
for
you. That's, you know, I have to say, that's, I don't know where you want to go with that. I mean,
however, as we all know, a great poster does not a great movie make, so.
Oh,
right,
okay.
But it can help get people into the theater who feel that way about it, that it's too serious, that it's a lesson on healthcare, you know. It could help in that way.
It could help, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, though. I hope the guy's an entertaining filmmaker, and I like the idea that he's calling it a comedy, because his movies are comedies.
They are comedy. Hey, we have a caller from the 202 area code. Would we like to take him?
Let's do it.
Him or her, I'm sorry. Let's do it. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. This is Greg Donaldson.
Hey, what's up, Greg? How you doing?
Fine. I just wanted to say hi, and it took me a while to realize you were talking about Michael Moore because I hadn't heard of the movie yet.
Right.
There's been very little promotion for the movie so far. There's no previews, you know. You can see that poster online, but so far there hasn't been a lot about it.
Yeah, just the cons press really right now.
And that's really what he uses as the startup for his promotion of the movie is the Cannes Film Festival.
But have no doubt, you're going to start seeing that stuff very soon, and very heavy, too, I'll bet.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think it will be a better DVD release?
It will definitely be a better DVD release, but I think it will also be a very good theatrical release. I mean, Michael Moore's owes the documentarians, whether they agree with him or not, owe him a great deal for making the documentary a profitable business.
Yeah.
You could say it starts with Hoop Dreams and Crumb in the mid-90s, but it's really Michael Moore's Roger and Me and then Bowling for Columbine and obviously Fahrenheit.
He's made the two most profitable documentaries of all time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and DVD plays a big role in that. You know, I remember getting my copy of Bowling for Columbine DVD at Walmart, of all places.
Yeah, that always scared me that you did that.
Thanks for calling. We appreciate your call,
Greg. Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome, guys.
Have a good day, Greg.
Okay, you too.
Thank you.
Bye.
What about this Coen Brothers movie? Have you guys read about this one?
Oh, yeah. No Country for Old Men,
the novel by
Cormac McCarthy.
It's a good book. And it's perfect for the Coen brothers, and I think they'll have much better luck than Billy Bob Thornton did with All the Pretty Horses.
Yeah.
My brother, I'll never forget, we went to go see that on Christmas Day, and he told the guy at the ticket office, you know, this is the prequel to Dude, Where's My Car? And the guy believed him, so I don't know what to make of that. But
that movie was taken away from Billy Bob, though. Apparently there was like a four-hour cut of that movie, which was what Billy Bob wanted. And
would a four-hour cut have been better?
That's what the people that have seen it, apparently. I know Ben Affleck saw it, and Ben Affleck raves about it. Says it's a travesty that the movie was never released in that form. Personally, I don't know. 4-hour movie, that seems a little long, no matter
what.
That
seems very long for, you know, it's, and I know this is in Matt Damon's, his, you know, the movies he's made, I mean, that and The Legend of Bagger Vance in the same year. We're not talking about quality cinema here. We're talking about vanity projects going astray.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he would get his footing back with The Bourne Identity, of all films. But
is this novel, the No Country for Old Men, I mean, is it along those same lines? No,
it's actually about drug runners, and it's a crime novel, of all things. It's a different novel from Cormac McCarthy, and very much like the, you know, he has this other novel, The Road, which is a post-apocalyptic novel, which is also very different. That's also Oprah's book club choice
right
now.
Within the past year.
Yeah, and these are different books from him. We're used to these kind of like these westerns from him. But it's I think the Coen brothers could do wonders with it, and it sounds like they have.
The reviews that I've read, have said that it's perfect material for the Coen brothers. The reviews from Cannes Film Festival, where they just premiered, say that it's one of their very best movies.
Yes, no, the reviews have been stellar so far. But going from the Coen brothers, there's also another big announcement last week, Jamie, that you broke, and that's that Al Pacino and Robert De Niro are going to be in a movie again.
It's like, you know, I'm erect right now just thinking about it.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
It's the biggest news that a geek like me, you know, could possibly get. This is going to be, even if the movie stinks, which it could, I don't know. It's just the novelty of having Pacino and De Niro share the entire movie together. You know, they play buddy cops, buddy detectives, however you want to phrase it.
Right, not just a diner sequence, I guess.
Exactly. And,
but that's,
you know,
one of the greatest scenes ever shot, by the way.
Heat is one of the all-time great films.
Yeah. Now, the idea that both of these, I would have to say, are the finest actors of their generation. I would throw in Jack Nicholson in there. But,
yeah,
you know, they're the finest actors of their generation. They're acting together, and they're going to be on screen for many scenes. It is very enticing.
It is enticing. But remember a couple years ago when Dustin Hoffman and Gene Hackman made Runaway Jury. And, you know, if you don't have this movie, this De Niro Pacino movie, it's going to be directed by John Avnet.
Righteous Kill is the title right now.
I'm sorry?
Righteous Kill is the title, if you didn't know. That's the working title.
That's a good title. Well, but he's not the most, you know, he's not the greatest. You don't think of him when you think about, you know, the artistic directors of our time, like the dependable directors. He's made a lot of movies. He's made some successful movies, but I just fear that this is going to end up like Runaway Jury, which, you know, you get those two great stars together, but you don't have someone taking control of the project, you know.
Right. I see what you're saying. I mean, I like Hackman, I like Hoffman, and I actually got to say, but I wouldn't put them in the same caliber as Pacino and De Niro. But I know what you're saying, because this was a big point when Runaway Jury came out, that scene in, I guess, the restroom. Is what everyone's talking about.
And it's the best moment in the movie. I think what you're thinking is, you're thinking that, like Runaway Jury, this sounds like more of a standard genre movie, where Heat, because Michael Mann was behind it, was anything but it very well could have been.
Exactly.
But Righteous Kill, it could be like your standard genre movie, but can anything really be standard when you have Pacino and De Niro sharing the entire screen time together? I hope not.
Believe me, I hope not.
No, that's the thing. I think that's the thing I was trying to get a couple weeks ago. I was no way demeaning Al Pacino, but I do think some of the choices, we talked about this many months ago, it's not so much that it's just what's the material, I guess, given to them.
Right.
And there's just so much you can do with it.
If they both chose this material, if they both agree on it, that it's worthy of their dedication, a director would actually have to go out of their way to mess it up, I would think. That would be my take on it.
Well, and the script is by the same guy that wrote Inside Man. What's his name?
Man,
Russell,
there you go.
Russell Gierwitz. That's a good script. So
no, that is. That's a very good script. So
we're going to have to wait and see. When's that scheduled to go into production?
August 6th.
August 6th. So hopefully sometime next year we'll be out.
Yeah, I'm such a geek. I'm like, I know everything about Pacino backwards and forwards. So I'm like, August 6th, they'll start shooting at 8 a.m.
Great for the anniversary of Hiroshima.
Is it really?
Yes, it is.
Well, this might be a major bomb then.
Oh, no. Okay, now I think since we are talking about cons,
right?
I'd like to talk about actually some of the past winners. Last year's winner, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, got a very limited release. A Ken Loach film. I actually saw it a couple months, about a month ago. The same weekend, I actually saw Grindhouse, a very good film. But you know, with the exception of like the two Michael Moore documentaries, Pulp Fiction, some of the films that win do not get a wide release here. And I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts on that.
Well, I think that we're pretty poor in our track record of supporting foreign films anyway in the American marketplace. But in terms of American winners at Cannes, it's interesting how they appreciate different American products than we do, American films than we do. And I'm thinking of the Coen brothers. I mean, the movie aficionados like us, we'll race to the next Coen brothers movie. I don't know that that's true of the general public or the people that hold festivals and award shows in our country, too.
Speaking of the Coen brothers, they've only really made one, in my mind, bad movie, and that's the remake of The Lady Killers. Otherwise, they have a stellar track record.
They do. I mean, if you like Intolerable Cruelty, then they do.
Right.
Intolerable Cruelty. I am in the minority in that.
If you count Lady Killers as their only bad movie, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm just saying it was their last movie. So as far as film fans go, you know, we kind of have a bad taste in our mouth because the Coen brothers, who we love, you know, the last movie they made, which was what, like 3 years ago or something?
It's all 2004, so yeah, it's 3 years.
So it's been like kind of up. It was just unbelievable the run that they went on of, you know, fantastic movie after fantastic movie, and then with Intolerable Cruelty, and then especially Lady Killers. It almost didn't even seem like the movies were made by them.
That's true. That's very true.
So I'm hoping that this is, like everyone says, a true return to form, you know, what they do best, crime movies. So
that's what they say. And I think the performance to look for in that film is Javier Bardem. He plays the villain, you know, so to speak, in the movie, and they say he's as cold-blooded as it gets. This is a performance that everybody's going to be talking about.
Oh, I agree with that. He's very good. He's very good in the Malkovich one, The Dancer Upstairs. He was good in Before Night Falls. He's good in even the films he has small parts in. He's a wonderful actor, very underrated, I may add. Also, there's some other. It's very interesting. This year, Cannes has probably a lot of Cannes' favorite children are back, and I think I'm going to mention some film titles and some names. And if stop me if there's anything that draws your interest. Obviously, we have David Fincher's Zodiac. We have Tarantino's Death Proof that are going to show. And a majority of Americans have seen those films, or sadly, well, a majority didn't see them. But there's another interesting film, and that would be My Blueberry Nights by Wong Kar-wai, probably one of the most visually stunning directors we have. And he's made such films as Chungking Express, 2046, and In the Mood for Love. I know I'm mentioning recent films, but at Cannes, it's very excited when he brings a film. And
yeah,
this is an English language debut, which stars Nora Jones, of all people.
Well, I think he's exceptional. You know, I happen to love 2046. He's a great visual filmmaker, obviously. And it would be interesting to see how he's able to deal with an entirely American cast.
But people are kind of saying that it's a little boring. Isn't that kind of the word out?
Well,
it was a little bit of a disappointment.
It is. If you go with the A.O. Scott kind of review or his article in the New York Times on Friday, it did seem like this was kind of a step down from the previous films I had mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, it's always hard. Even 2046 was not regarded in contrast to In the Mood for Love. Was actually considered by some people a step down.
Right. You know, but you have to watch it differently. A lot of foreign films, particularly his work, you have to kind of retune your brain. It's like Lynch films on how to watch a movie. You just need to kind of sit back and allow yourself to get lost in it. And if you can't do that, and some material I can't do that with, then it does play boring. But if you can do it, it hypnotizes you.
True.
They're leisurely paced. They're visually just stunning. But it's all about just trying to find your way into the groove of the movie. And if you can't do that, then you know, I can see where it would be laborious and long and boring. You know, so maybe he didn't make that in My Blueberry Nights, but for me, he did it in 2046 just perfectly.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so funny. Every year at Con, there's these movies that come out, and, you know, some of them are gigantic successes at Con, and in America, not so much. And then there's movies that show at Con, and then, you know, no response there. They come out over here, and America loves them. So the their taste in movies is so different from ours. It's so strange how that's still the case.
I think when I look at what the films that are popular, the films that win, let's take Gus Van Sant's Elephant,
right,
that won. I noticed that they like to pick films that portray Americans as, you know, as we are, violent savages, I guess. Mm-hmm. And they like this to pick. That's Bowling for Columbine and Elephant come to light. They do love to really hone in on that. You could say with Pulp Fiction even.
Right,
they
Wild
like,
at Heart.
At Heart. They love when these films portray us as, you know, violent selves. And
Barton Fink's another one.
Barton Fink, kind of. But I also noticed that last year's winner, the Ken Loach film, Wind That Shakes the Barley, because a lot of people look at that as an allegory for the Iraq occupation. And this was a film that dealt with the British occupation of Northern Ireland in the Irish Civil War during the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And Ken Loach was obviously making a parallel to what's going on today with Iraq. And I just noticed that there is this, they love to pick on these themes, especially, I guess, now that we're in the Bush era, these anti-Bush films, if you will, or at least themes that speak to that.
Yeah, I mean it's you know, that's why they love Michael Moore, too, because Michael Moore actually points out in Sicko that he applauds the French for their great healthcare system, and why is America so behind the French? You know, so I think you could argue that there's a reason why they like Michael Moore so much, and it ties right into that.
Right, right. Are there any other? Are there any other films that interest you that are showing right now? Like the films go out of the competition. We have the Michael Winterbottom, the A Mighty Heart with Angelina Jolie about Daniel Pearl's widow.
Well, we talked about A Mighty Heart, and certainly that's a worthy film, and I hope it finds an audience, because I think it has all the markings of a really stellar movie. But even from a fun point of view, everything at Cannes isn't all stuffy and everything. You know, they're premiering Ocean's 13.
I mean, like we said, Death Proof, and
Death Proof is recut too. Death Proof is recut into a feature length, or he added a lot of footage to it.
Why aren't we there right now?
It's going to be released throughout all of Europe that way, right? I mean, they had intended that.
Wait, why are we doing this show if there's a new cut of Death Proof? Why didn't someone tell me this? Wait a minute. Whoa, wait a minute. There's a new cut of Death Proof, and I'm sitting here in Silver Spring, Maryland? That's insane.
Yeah,
just
because we're radio stars, dude, doesn't mean we can afford to go to
I'm not saying that, but, I mean, there's a print of Death Proof we have not seen.
Saying there's a new print of Death Proof is like saying there's a new scent at the
All right,
store.
I realize. I know it didn't sit well with you. I know that you had, like, irritable bowel syndrome with the film, but come on. I mean, for the rest of us who didn't like it, for the few of us who did see it, because, you know, our guest is not calling in.
Our guest hasn't called in? Okay.
No.
Well, let's just, you know, let's wrap up Canon, and then that's it. Let's do our midweek promo and talk about the subject everyone wants to talk about this week.
That's
anyway.
What I want to talk about.
Let's do it.
All right. Okay. We are going to. All right. Here we go.
Okay. This is our midweek promo that you're going to do.
Middleton, and this is breaking news about everyone's favorite internet radio show, Movie Geeks United. Next Sunday, join the Movie Geeks for a very special episode paying tribute to one of our most legendary film directors, David Lynch. During the episode, hear exclusive live interviews with people that have worked behind the scenes with Lynch on everything from Wild at Heart to Twin Peaks. On Sunday, June 3rd, the Movie Geeks will dedicate the hour to their favorite comedy of all time, The Big Lebowski, with their special guest, Scott Shuffit, co-founder of Lebowski Fest and co-author of the book, I'm a Lebowski, You're a Lebowski. Finally, on Sunday, June 10th, the Movie Geeks show some love for The Sopranos, only hours before the series finale. During the same broadcast, they'll also delve into a controversial topic of the week, Can Movies Inspire Real Life Violence? With invaluable input from a renowned media psychologist. What more could a movie geek possibly want? For Movie Geeks United News, I'm Tiffany Littleton.
Okay, thank you, Tiffany. We got a lot of great shows coming up.
We really do, and I'm telling everyone out there, stick to the blog announcements. Look for the bulletins and everything, because we might have some big news about future shows, possibly as early as next week's show. People guess that you absolutely won't want to miss. We got some big announcements coming up, but just in terms of content. I know that a lot of our listeners out there are crazy about David Lynch films. He's basically the most unique of the American directors out there. And dedicating an hour to him, it's geek heaven for us. And we're just so thrilled to be able to bring that to you. And Lebowski, too. I mean, is there a bigger cult phenomenon than the Big Lebowski? So we're really going to celebrate those movies in a very fun, very informative way that people won't want to miss out on.
No, that's very good. And I guess let's go to the topic we've all been waiting for.
Yes.
Let's just go to it right now. We are going to talk about tonight, for the remainder of the show, directors that we think, 10 directors, and I'm not even 10 directors, but directors we think really matter, a new generation of directors.
Yeah.
I mean, we made a list of 10 directors. Well, Jamie and Chris did. I'm going to first read this list to you.
Okay.
And then I want you guys to tell me what you think. But I would like to first read the list, and you hold your groans or your applause or whatever. And I'm also wanted to say something. You know, I meant today, because, you know, Friday's the 30th anniversary of Star Wars. I was going to drop some, some of the heart of the fine quotes from the saga. I may still do that, just variously, like someone with Tourette's syndrome, just blurt them out. I don't know if I'm going to do that now, but just be on the lookout. But, all right, without any, our first director is Darren Aronofsky. We all know how I feel about him. Chris Nolan, P.T. Anderson, Wes Anderson, Guillermo del Toro, he's already established, but he's a god anyways, Alexander Payne, David Fincher, Sofia Coppola, and Spike Jones, and last, but by no means least, Lily Tomlin's best friend, David O. Russell.
Yeah. David O. Russell was a real kind of iffy choice to go to. While we enjoy everything he's done, his future in filmmaking has a big question mark.
It's very interesting you bring this up about David O. Russell and about all these guys. A couple months ago, Sharon Waxman, who, by the way, wrote probably one of the quintessential book on the directors we're talking about, Rebels on the Backlot. If you don't own it, you should own it. I swear by it. The book has done enough damage to get me to really think about picking up a camera again, or picking up a camera in general, than I care to admit. The other book that you should own, and our very good friend Tony Farinella interviewed this gentleman, James Motren's The Sundance Kids. I can't recommend these books should be in your library. You should own them. They should be, if I had a hotel, they would be in every room of
They'd
the
be
hotel.
Your yeah.
I want to say something about this list. Now, we're not talking about guys. You know, when Jamie and I sat down to make this list, what inspired it basically was, you know, in the past couple weeks, the three of us have had conversations about that are a little bit pessimistic about the outlook of movies. So we kind of wanted to say, okay, who can we look to then? If movies are turning in kind of an unfortunate direction, who are the guys, not necessarily unestablished or established, but who are the young guys now who are still going to be making movies, who we can count on to be still making movies in 20 years, you know, because it seems like these days the best movies are made by people like Spielberg, Scorsese, Clint Eastwood. These guys are getting up there. So, you know, and it's going to be a changing of the guard. And Jamie and I sort of came up with this list together as just 10 to start with of the really dependable young filmmakers out there.
And you get a sense from them that the best is yet to come.
Right.
You know,
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. Whichever one of you said that, I hope you're right.
Yeah. That was Jamie. That was me.
Okay, I hope you're right. I'm going to hold you to that. I'm going to hold you to that 20 years from now, okay?
Oh, wow, okay.
Okay, I'm going to hold you to that, because we're going to be doing a variation of this show every, you know, in some format, whatever the media is out there, folks. This is not a fly-by-night operation. This is the real deal. I know, stay on target. But there you go. That's the quote number one, okay?
Stay on target.
Hold up, man. Okay. I think David Fincher and Del Toro are established. And the reason I say that, before you guys, and I actually think they're legendary, David Fincher, speaking of Star Wars, got his big break at Lucasfilm while Return of the Jedi was being made.
Right.
And, you know, he's been around. If you read the Sundance Kids and the Rebels, he's been around for a long time. He's been in this business. He's been, you know, fist fights galore with the companies. And he's really, I actually think he is kind of a little bit above this class. You know, he's in the next generation, in between.
Really
generation.
Is. And honestly, Jerry, that's why when we came up with this list, he was the first one we, you know, I mean, he really is the top of this list. When we talk about, and I'm sure you're the same way, like when we look at this list, basically what Jamie and I were saying is if you took every other filmmaker off the list and you just had those 10 that we named left,
yeah.
Would you have a lot of, you know, diversity in movies? Would you have a lot of quality films still being made? And at the top,
look,
and I think you would, and at the top of that list would be David Fincher, arguably the
Fincher,
most talented
Fincher,
of all of them.
Fincher is in his 40s. He's got 30 more years of filmmaking left in him to get up to Scorsese, or 20 years. I'm not sure how old Scorsese is. But
gentlemen, we have a caller from the 323 area code. I am going to let them on.
Okay.
Hello, welcome to Movie Geeks United.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. This is Ben, but you may know me as the Ultimate Rabbit from MySpace.
Ah, yes, we do. We love your reviews. They're wonderful.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Well, I just wanted to call say hi and also to commiserate on being one of the other people who has not seen the longer version of Death Proof.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm telling you right now, I'm like thinking of really just leaving right now, getting on a plane. I mean,
yeah, that would be fun. That would be fun. I've never been to Cannes, and that would be a good reason to go. So yeah, and I mean, I loved Grindhouse. I thought that was one of the best movies I'd seen this year so far. And a lot of my friends didn't like Death Proof, just mainly because, and I totally understand, it's too wordy. But at the same time, I mean. His movies in general, Quentin's movies in general, are very wordy and for a good reason usually. I mean, he does take a lot of time in terms of setting up character, which I think really pays off like the latter half of the film.
No, you're right. It does pay off. You know what? The only problem, I'm going to actually grant to the critics here, I'm going to give them their concession that they so badly want me to say, that they've been wanting me to say for 2 months. It is only bad in the sense it follows Planet Terror, which is a rip-rousing, awesome, you know, it's the Ayatollah of rock and roll. It's a great film.
Right.
But
yeah,
it all of a sudden, Death Proof takes everything to a standstill. You're
right.
On this roll. You're on this high. You had these three great trailers, you know, imaginary trailers. And then, all right, I will say this, though. The Europeans are lucky. They're going to get this thing as two separate films, and they're lucky. They don't deserve to be that lucky, goddammit. But they're lucky, and they're going to get, you know, the way this, you know, Death Proof is going to work, and people are going to say, you know, it's a great film. They're not going to say, God damn it, Jerry Dennis, you were right. It's a great film. It's a masterpiece.
Right. I actually have to disagree with you. I think if you see that movie on its own, having not followed Planet Terror and those three previews, I think it would actually even be more difficult to watch.
Did Quentin Tarantino shit in your cereal?
What's that?
Did Quentin Tarantino shit in your cereal or something?
Yeah, I love Quentin Tarantino, man. I love everything he's done. And I don't hate Death Proof.
I know you don't, dude. I'm just playing with you. I'm just playing, babe.
But on its own, it doesn't. You don't have any sort of excitement at the beginning of the movie. I mean, like, that excitement left over from Planet Terror is what got me through to the car chase.
Okay, I'll give you that.
Let's take a look at the list, and let's examine kind of why Chris and I didn't automatically put Tarantino on it.
Well, I wouldn't. I would say he's already legendary as it is. He's already
right. That's one reason. But the other reason I would argue would be, and Chris spoke to this a couple of weeks ago. Tarantino is in a little bit of a rut now, and I don't see that he recognizes it necessarily.
Oh, he does. Oh, he does. He has said this in interviews. He admits that he's in a rut now. Whether he'll do anything about it, well, we both know that's a totally different story.
You know, I think you can look at Tarantino's career, and you could say, was Pulp Fiction the high point? You know, is there anything, is he going to bring back that greatness of Tarantino again? Is he going to finally write dialogue that is unique to each character. It doesn't sound like the same person, you know, which is one of the arguments that I think, Chris, you brought up about Death Proof.
Yeah.
They talk and say nothing.
Every character is Quentin Tarantino. He doesn't know. And if you go back and you watch Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, characters know when to shut the hell up. Sometimes people just shut the hell up. But nobody does that in Death Proof for sure. And there's a little bit of it in Kill Bill. Don't get me wrong. I love the Kill Bill movies. And I like Death Proof.
Yeah.
But I think that he kind of run out of steam where his trademark dialogue is concerned.
The others on the list, P.T. Anderson, we're talking about the people that are most likely to carry the torch of our Scorsese's and Altman's and that kind of thing.
This is a film school generation.
P.T. Anderson is hard to have someone that fits better into that mold. He is Scorsese and Altman, put together.
He is Altman. It's also very important to bring up about it on P.T. Anderson is that on Prairie Home Companion, he was put on as
ghost director.
He's ghost director because they were worried that, you know, and obviously, sadly, Robert Altman did pass it. He was going to pass away during that film.
He's ideal for an Altman type.
Oh, he is, and he has. I think Altman, one of Altman's best films is Shortcuts, and I definitely think Anderson did that with Magnolia.
Right. Well, you look at Anderson, and you can divide him into those two people. He has the storytelling ability of Altman and the camera, kind of the visceral camera work of Scorsese. He's a perfect hybrid of those two, and I think that he's a real clear representative of the future of filmmaking. If you look at our greats that are passing or on the way to passing now.
Okay, Ben, are you still
along
on the line?
Along with David Fincher, he seems interested in growing as a filmmaker and challenging himself. Even you know, one project is not exactly a carbon copy of the next. He's interested
is
in
Ben
trying...
still on the line with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. No, did you want to add anything else, sir?
I like how you're bringing up all these directors right now, especially P.T. Anderson, because and Magnolia and Shortcuts are very similar movies, and also I'm very eager to see what P.T. Anderson's going to be doing next, because it's been a couple of years since Punch Drunk
Love.
He's
got a big movie next.
Yeah, that's what I heard. It's with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, or it's based on us. I believe it's Sinclair Lewis's book Oil.
I think that's what it's based on. Yeah,
it's going to be good.
The title of the film is There Will Be Blood.
It's going to be quite a film, from what I hear.
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Thank you so much for calling
in,
Ben.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Have a good day, sir.
Yeah, you too.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, we have another call. We have a call from your neck of the woods on the 863 area code. I'm going to let them on.
Okay, that could be our guest.
All right, we'll see. Welcome to Movie Geeks United.
Hey, it's Dave DeBort.
Hey.
Hey, I'm so sorry. Listen, I'm in a busy restaurant. I'm going to walk outside now. Here's what happened. I'm sorry I was late. I was actually, there's a film that I'm shooting this summer, and I was on the phone with the producer, and we were kind of hashing out a lot of stuff that was going on. So I was like, I'm sorry I was late, but, you know, it was film business, so it's kind of related to the show.
No, that's understandable. I mean, you got to do what pays the bills. I understand
Right.
All right. Exactly. Well, could you tell our viewers a little bit about you, or our listeners a little bit about yourself?
I'm a filmmaker. I don't know. What else should I say? I went to Cannes last year because that's the topic. So I was in Cannes, and the French are rude, but the food is great, and I had a blast. It was a lot of fun, and the cool thing was that one of the things is that you could argue that it's the most glamorous event in the world, you know, every year. And I think that argument would win if you're there. I mean, even Fashion Week in Paris is a big deal, but over 200,000 people descend on this little town on the French Riviera for this one thing. And, you know, half of them are paparazzi. So wherever you go, you have people clicking things, and, you know, when you're walking the red carpet, even if you're just going to go see a film, you have people, you know, popping off shots just in case you may be somebody.
Okay, let me ask you this. What was the film that you brought over?
It's called Success Story Part 1, and it's a short film. I mean, when I say short, it's short, 3 minutes long. And it stars, it's really just two actors. One of them is an actor, an actress from Tampa who's really talented. She hasn't done a lot, but she's very good. And her name is Osa Winter. But then the other person, the lead in it, is Jason Matthew Smith, who's done a ton of work, and he was, I don't know if you guys ever saw Playmakers on ESPN.
I remember
he was
it.
The
yeah.
he was
yeah.
the he was the lead to that. He was the bald white linebacker who had, you know, anger issues and all that sort of thing.
Oh wow.
So he's great in the film too, so.
So you took him there.
Yeah.
What was your experience at Con like from a filmmaker perspective?
Well, for one thing, I found out that the rednecks were right. It isn't Con, it's Can.
Can, okay.
And I could not believe it. I'm like, it's got to be, come on, man, it's got to be Con. And I went to so many locals. You know, I'd be in the bakery getting, you know, really, you know, tasty little baked treat or whatever. I'd go get coffee or go get a meal. And I would just make it a point to say, just curious, what's the name of this town? And every time they'd be like, Monsieur, it is Can. So, you know, they convinced me. So I guess it's called Can.
Okay,
you know?
I'll go with that. I'll definitely go with that. Let me ask you this. Is there a downside to anything, to bringing their film over there? I mean, obviously the pluses are big, but is there a downside?
Well, you know, it's expensive. I mean, you have to go over there. I mean, by the time that I decided that I was going to attend last year, all the reasonably priced hotels had been snatched up, and the only ones that were left were, like, the lowest price was, like, 460 euros a night.
Wow.
Wow.
The euro is, like, times 1.3 American dollars.
Right.
So it wasn't even $460. It was 460 times 1.3.
Okay. You really need to be Bob the Gambler or James Bond to afford to stay there.
Pretty much. So that's why cheap people like myself, what we did was we went ahead and stayed in Nice and then just took the train over and back, you know, day and night.
Now, what's it like showing a 3-minute film there? I mean, do you show it with other short films, or do people shuffle into a theater, sit down 3 minutes, and then shuffle out?
No. What they had was they had this thing called the Can Market.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, here's the funny thing. The Can Film Festival, yes, it is a big deal. It's the world's, you know, most prestigious, yada, yada. But the truth is, the reason why it's such a big deal is not because of the festival. It's actually, the festival's a big deal because of the market. And I didn't know that until I got over there. And then when I realized, wait a second, you know, 80% of the film business that is conducted in the world is conducted during those 10 or 11 days in that little, you know, French Riviera town.
Right.
Then it made sense. And a buddy of mine is a distribution guy, which was a really cool story too, because he got me into these yacht parties that were fantastic. But he explained it to me too. He said, Dave, yeah, the festival, it's nice, you know, how nice. But he said the real reason why all the major players are here is because of the market, because all the business deals are done there.
You're absolutely right, and that's why you see a lot of, you know, we're talking about the announcement of the Pacino De Niro film that was made this year at Cannes Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
They use that venue to announce it so they can sell Singapore and Hong Kong.
That's
and, you know,
right.
All different markets.
It's very, very frightening. Someone has probably announced this week of a GoBots movie. So, I want to thank you very much for calling in, but unfortunately the clock tells me I have to terminate this fascinating discussion, but I really do appreciate you calling in.
Yeah,
letting our listeners know what you do in the film, and I wish you lots of luck with your future projects, because I know you want to go there next year, and I wish you a lot of luck with that.
I appreciate it. Yeah, we're planning on going next year, so maybe you'll have me on next year, and I'll tell you what I did.
Definitely, we'll definitely do that. Thank you very much, friend.
Take care.
All right,
bye. Thank you. Well, we got him in. That was good.
No, that was good. I'm very happy to hear that.
So we got what are we doing now? You want to talk?
What
about
are we doing? We're going to go back to directors.
Okay.
We're going back to directors because this is a very important topic, one that we could fill up the whole night and the whole week with.
Absolutely.
So where did we leave off? We left off, I guess we were talking about Fincher, and we're talking about P.T. Anderson. We had Ben on the phone. And
well, we talked about P.T. Anderson. Why don't we talk a little bit about the other Anderson?
The other Anderson is very important. Wes Anderson, I did some, you know, reading David Thompson's Biographical Dictionary and Film last night, and he has a one-sentence thing for Wes Anderson. Now, this was the edition written back in 2002. He says, watch this space. I think something will happen. Now, I have to say I do think something has happened with Wes Anderson. He's made some incredible, incredible films.
Yeah.
Well, I think even more important than that, I mean, I don't disagree. I love all of his films.
But I think what he has more than any of these other directors is a core of very loyal fans. I mean, I think probably more so than, you know, any of the other names on this list, whether it's P.T. Anderson or David Fincher. Wes Anderson fans will see anything that he puts out. They know when he's making a movie, and they seem to get bigger, like more into movies as they come along. And they're little movies. These are little movies.
They are little movies, there's no doubt.
But his fans are just...
We are rabid.
Very, very loyal.
And I'm all for anyone that can make me actually enjoy a Jason Schwartzman performance.
That's true.
We have a caller from the 571 area code.
This is probably Mark.
Okay. Welcome to Movie Geeks United.
Hey.
Hey.
What's going on? It's Mark.
Hey, Mark. You guys are like the Amazing Kreskin. You know this stuff, okay?
I like Wes Anderson films too. I think even more so with the fan base that they have, that he's got a really loyal cast or actors that are, you know, always wanting to be in his movies. You know, like Angelica Houston and, you know, Bill Murray and of course Jason Schwartzman. So, whenever any group of actors or actresses, you know, want to work with a particular director, I think that makes it even more enjoyable, and then you can certainly see it in the movie. So,
yeah, and very accomplished actors too, and that speaks to his talent. Something so young that, you know, Angelica Houston's crazy about him, and, you know, just a slew of, like, great actors.
Gene Hackman. I mean, Gene Hackman's the funniest thing in, you know, Royal Tenenbaums, and he's the funniest thing, but then, of course, there's other really funny performances in it, too. So.
Oh, he's great. I mean,
the way Hackman holds a cigarette in the Royal Tenenbaums is funny to me.
Yeah, he's, from the beginning, they've likened him on screen and off to, you know, this generation's Hal Ashby, because his movies have that kind of comedic sensibility to them, but at the same time, they have some serious elements, too, and apparently he's just a really fun guy to make a movie with. Like you say, people keep coming back, so.
I would imagine so. I mean, and you know, we were talking about Jason Schwartzman earlier, and Mark, I know that you appreciate Schwartzman and Marie Antoinette, and more importantly, you know, Sofia Coppola's work in Lost in Translation and Marie Antoinette.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I like Sofia Coppola movies, but they're, to me, really pretty to look at. And then beyond that, with the exception of Lost in Translation, like, Marie Antoinette is just style over substance. To me, at least. I mean, I don't know. I like the movie, but, you know, you're looking at a pretty painting for 2 hours. You kind of want to move on to another gallery, another painting.
Yeah, that's true. I always looked at the movie as more about herself than anything else.
I think that her
choices in Marie Antoinette, while I didn't quite like the movie, I admired the direction that she went.
Right.
Because she made it an entirely personal movie. She absolutely made the movie she wanted to make. And I think, if anything, that's the one thing that she's gotten from her father. Stick to your guns. Stick to your vision. You know.
And like Mark said, she doesn't do that in Lost in Translation. It was kind of an experimental film, which is another reason why she's in this category. Virgin Suicides isn't like that. Lost in Translation isn't like that. She did something else. She wants to grow and try new things as a filmmaker.
I think the Virgin Suicides is nothing short of brilliant.
It's a fantastic movie.
It's beautiful. It's incredible. It's lyrical. Really, I do think when Coppola and Dunst work together, magic happens. We have our special guest for the remainder of the show is on the line, and I would like to patch him through.
Mark.
Yo.
You there, Mark? Thank you very much,
Mark, for calling.
Hey, no problem, no problem.
All right,
you guys
have
later.
A good night, sir.
All right.
Okay, and I believe this should be our guest. Hello, welcome to Movie Geeks United.
Hey guys, it's Jeremy.
All right.
How's
it going? Jeremy. What's going on?
We ready to get our flick picks of the week on?
I think we are. You're ready.
Okay, I think we should let our special guest go first.
Okay, well, this one's actually kind of interesting. I was racking my brain trying to think of the flick pick for this week, and it actually, just by coincidence, it actually ties into a lot of things you've been discussing in these past couple of weeks on the show, specifically last week's shocking revelation about Michael Bay.
Yeah, he's throwing stuff at my house. He drives by and throws rocks at our house since that show. So.
Oh, he's our number one fan. What are you talking about? He loves us.
Well, I'm sure, yeah.
So I figured just in case people want to see just how far the apple has fallen from the tree, they can rent this movie, this John Frankenheimer film, 1966. It it starred, of all people, Rock Hudson, and it's called Seconds.
Wow.
Wow, okay.
And it kind of tells the story of this middle-aged guy. He's really, you know, just miserable, unhappy with his life. He's a banker, boring wife, boring, takes the train home from work every day. And, you know, in the first 10 minutes of this film, 10 to 20 minutes, are some of the most depressing.
Yes, it is. It's a very depressing film.
But once you get past that, then you have this whole concept that comes in there with he goes to the secret organization and they give him a new life and they transform him physically. They give him a new voice. They give him a new face and he becomes Rock Hudson.
Well, who wouldn't want to become Rock Hudson?
Hey, Rock Hudson, I got it. Rock was one of our finest actors. Giant, Ice Station Zebra, Written on the Wind, All That Heaven Allows. You guys aren't bad-mouthing Rock Hudson on my show.
Well, you know, the funny thing is with Rock Hudson,
the Martian,
you know,
Chronicles and the Vegas Strip Wars, okay? Come on. I mean,
The funny thing is with Rock Hudson, he's known for all these, you know, these silly, you know, romantic comedies with Doris Day and everything. But, you know, he's really good here. And, you know, and this movie, I mean, was made in 1966. And, I mean, it's so, you know, it fits into that category. Jerry, you were talking about last week when you talked about Little Children, about
The
Swimmer.
Oh, The Swimmer, yeah.
Yeah, this is a movie kind of in a similar vein.
I agree with that.
And it's one of those weird movies that could only come out of the 60s.
Absolutely. It is definitely a product of its time. And
I would rank it maybe a notch below The Swimmer, which I consider a master. One of my favorite movies ever is The Swimmer.
You have very good taste.
Thank you.
You have very good taste.
I have weird taste.
Nah, there's nothing. There's no such thing as weird taste. That argument you can throw out the window. That's bullshit. If you came over here and told me, oh, Blood Rain was my favorite movie, then you know
yeah,
we're going to have
worried,
words.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but, and this is kind of like Rock Hudson. I mean, it's kind of, and Burt Lancaster, those roles were way out of the box for those two guys. I mean, nobody expected them to do.
I think they
might
have expected Burt, because Burt had, in his roles, he does play the tough guy, you know, the Killers. And Criss Cross and those films. But it was there, it was always there, and it really comes to light, I think, in the Atlantic City.
Oh, yeah.
Where
that
really, he reaches deep, digs deep, and pulls out another, like, swimmer-like performance. So,
yeah,
no,
that was good in Atlantic City. That's a classic.
Yeah.
But,
it speaks to the strength of Frankenheimer, too, because it's been many years since I've watched it. But for him to take on a project that it is so out of the box, and visually, too, with the way he worked his camera, it was
unbelievable, especially the ending.
Yeah. It was a very revolutionary kind of movie.
And, you know, those two movies, you know, everybody thinks scary, you know, think of horror movies. These two movies are really psychologically scary.
Yeah.
They're scary in a different way.
Right.
So, and it's a shame that the movie was such a colossal failure. It actually pretty much ruined Rock Hudson's career, and he was really upset about it, I heard, for a while.
I remember hearing that, too.
It was
well,
just
we got
a huge failure.
We got less than 7 minutes. Chris and Jamie, you want to get your flick picks in?
I'll go.
Okay.
My flick pick is actually something more recent. It just came out on DVD this past week, and it really impressed me. It's called The Dead Girl.
Okay.
Oh,
and I know that a lot of people won't pick it up because, you know, it's called The Dead Girl. But it sounds like it's the most depressing movie ever made. And it is very depressing, but at the same time, it's about the discovery of a dead girl and the different people in that girl's life who have been touched by her death one way or another, whether it's the mother or the person that happened upon the body. It kind of reads like a great book. And every chapter is a different character's story. And
so she's dead throughout the film, then?
Yes, she is. But she has the last 15-minute section, so you see what led to her death. And I'm telling you, Brittany Murphy, don't count her out, because she is awe-inspiring in this movie. Just tears her heart out. And Marcia Gay Harden is in it, and she's incredibly emotional performance. It has so many great performances.
An old friend of yours. Miss Garden.
A personal friend. But go see it. Absolutely. I recommend it 100%.
Okay, Chris?
My recommendation this week is actually from one of the directors on our list. It's David O. Russell's sophomore movie, Flirting with Disaster.
Oh, good choice.
Oh, great movie.
It is kind of an example of the movies that that I don't think, but that Jamie and Jerry think are, you know, kind of not as prevalent these days. It's a personal, a little personal movie about this guy who's on a search to find his real parents. That's Ben Stiller. And it's got a great cast from Alan Alda to Lily Tomlin to Patricia Arquette. And it's just hilarious from beginning to end. It's real nutty, neurotic, screwball comedy that every time I watch it, it's one of those. Every time I watch it, I laugh at something new that I didn't catch before. There's so much going on in it. And I think anyone can enjoy it. I've shown it to several people, and they always love it. But it just kind of disappeared, unfortunately.
No, it's a very good movie. It's a wonderful
movie. It's a very
film.
Inspiring cast, too. The cast is, like, from all over the... Alan Alda and Mary Tyler Moore and Ben Stiller. And it's just, the cast itself is irresistible.
Well,
and
a
it's
lot of people
it's a joke a second. Like, tons of jokes in this movie.
Yeah,
all over.
There are. I like the scene where he looks at the, you know, when the first person he goes to, the first person he thinks is parent, and the picture of Ronald Reagan, he goes, I never felt I had appreciated him enough when he was in office.
Right.
okay, I guess I'm going to go to my flick pick, and then we have another caller, and I'd like to keep Jeremy on the line. We don't have that much time. I'm also going to let Jamie in a little bombshell here. We don't have the closing music, okay? Technical difficulties, I'm sorry. You can beat the shit out of me later. But my flick pick is Martin Donovan's Apartment Zero, and I was looking through my VHS collection. Yes, folks, I still keep the VHS, you know, just in case, you know, there's some sort of apocalyptic struggle and all that's
you
left.
You've got to help me out here. I haven't seen this one.
It is a Martin Donovan film with Colin Firth and Hart Spotsner, and it's just a very well-done thriller, very Hitchcock-like. And I watched it the summer that we had really American independent film really took off in some – independent film itself took off in 1990. You had Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. You had the Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down. You had – The Cook, the Thief, the Wife, and His Lover, and you had Hal Hartley's The Unbelievable Truth. And then you have this film that was out and then came out on videotape. And it's just a wonderful thriller, mystery, very small film, and I believe it is out on DVD. I'm not positive on that, but someone did tell me, and it is worth your time. It is worth
your time.
I'm going
to check that one out.
Yeah, okay, and I'd like, we have 2 minutes, a little... 3 minutes left. I'd like to let that we have an air caller from the 717 area code, and I'm going to patch them through. Hello, welcome to Movie Geeks United.
Hey, guys, it's Ty.
Hi.
Hey, Ty.
Hi. I got in finally.
Okay, yeah, sorry about that. We had some...
Yeah. What's going on?
Not much. What's up with you?
Hey, I caught the show late today. My bad.
That's okay. It's archived. I mean, you got things to do. We understand this.
I have lots of things to do.
Yeah.
Anyway... I just have a comment about Wes Anderson. Could he be the new Woody Allen in the sense that everybody wants to work with him? I mean, if you look at Woody Allen movies, everybody is in Woody Allen movies.
Right.
The same with Wes Anderson.
That's a very good point. I hope Wes Anderson doesn't marry one of his stepchildren one day. I mean, that's a very good point. You know, we were just watching Match Point was on earlier this week on one
that's
of the
That's a great film, Match Point.
And that's one of the one of
I think
Woody
it's
Allen,
one of his best films.
One of his best films in quite some time.
It was a bit of a comeback. Of course, then he took a couple of steps back after that, but it was that film was big for him.
Yeah.
If you look at Wes Anderson, you know, he's hit all these movie stars or these great actors in his movies, and he's just starting out. I think Woody Allen has a lot of people that come on his film because they just want to be in a Woody Allen movie and his reputation precedes him. So for Wes Anderson to reach this place so early in his career, it really speaks volumes of his talent.
See, the thing about Woody Allen is, I mean, up until Match Point, he's made some crap. I mean, just horrible movies, in my
Hold opinion. The phone there, Chief.
Chris, I know you're...
Now, are you talking about...
Wait a minute. Are you talking about, like, in between maybe... If you said the period between Sweet and Lowdown to Match Point, I'd say yes. But are you talking about movies before Sweet and Lowdown?
Well, there's some movies, no, after. Like, Small Time Crooks, I did not like at all.
Oh, there's one, though. All the great scenes are in the trailer.
Exactly. And, you know, anything else?
Anything else
I'll give you Anything Else and Hollywood Ending. But small-time crooks, man.
Can you give me some before Sweet and Lowdown, like Deconstructing Harry?
Deconstructing Harry is actually Woody Allen's probably one of the best comedies he's done in quite some time.
No, I'm sorry. I just...
I have to disagree. I think it is the film that he addresses something very important. We only got a couple seconds left, but he addresses his personal life, and it's also a remake, if you will, of Bergman's Wild Strawberries.
I've never seen that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
How dare you disagree with Movie Geeks?
Yeah, how dare you? We're coming to your house tonight. Okay,
all
folks.
All right, guys. Thanks for
all right,
tonight.
That's all the time we have this week. Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Thank you,
goodbye.
Guys.
Good night.
Good night,
everyone. Bye-bye. Thank you.